ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
If we really let this rip, we're looking at replacing the entire human species as the smartest things on the planet. We're looking at sort of an AI-run civilization.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis, joining you from Wurundjeri Country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And PK, it was all about our glorious Federation again this week in politics, wasn't it? I love these Federation weeks.
You are a woman of much love for the Federation. The Federation's giving us a few headaches at the moment. National Cabinet happened. It was, I suppose, the big story of the week. It was set to be a showdown, but it kind of ended in a whimper, in my view, for the Prime Minister, who appeared to kind of roll over when it comes to the two states of Queensland and the NT, who pushed for a different model when it comes to powering these AI data centres. Basically, they like the fossil fuels. He did get rolled, didn't he?
No, I was really interested to see how he was going to get out of this one. And yeah, I think he got rolled, but we'll see how this plays out. But let's put it this way. I think he's gazumped his Energy Minister, Chris Bowen. So we can talk about that further with our guest. Also this week, spectacularly, One Nation's immigration policy was in focus. Barnaby Joyce and Pauline Hanson had to mop up after their shiny new recruit, the member for Farrow, David Farley, suggested on Insiders, no less, quite a marquee performance for him, that the minor party's immigration numbers wouldn't be too different. That was the quote, too different to Labor's. Well, imagine what that set off. This comes as Labor and the Coalition are still finalising their immigration policies and pushing them out. I'm getting the feeling, pushing them out as far as they can. This all comes in the week that it's the 25th anniversary of the Tampa affair, PK, which, you know, I was intimately involved with covering at the time. I'll never forget that press conference when John Howard announced this. It looms large still over how we approach immigration policy in this country, the politics of it and the policy. So we'll be talking about that too.
And someone who has been watching this all closely this week is Ashley Raper, political editor at Network 10. Ash, welcome back to the Party Room.
Thank you for having me.
Ash, it's great to have you. Just like the old days. Ash, before we get underway, I think we should note the unfolding disaster in Nepal and Tibet, where floods have killed over 160 people, many more missing still, 34 Australians at this point in time when we're recording this still missing. So it looks like a dire natural disaster. The Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister here have released statements on these events. DFAT officials are working hard, trying to be in contact with Australians, assist Australians and families. And I think it's worth saying, PK and Ash, that our thoughts are with those affected, and this is a developing story and such a horrible story.
Yeah, it's one of those stories, I think, that's just going to dominate the next period of time. Just obviously, just on a humanitarian level, this is a very struggling region of the world, a developing country, difficulties there, so many locals who clearly have lost their lives, Australians potentially, that's a big deal. Ash, that's pretty much going to consume the government's efforts, really. DFAT already clearly on the job. But that this is kind of next level stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the scenes, you know, that we've come out this morning are just horrific. And, you know, we haven't got much at all from DFAT or the Prime Minister apart from their initial responses. And obviously they're just trying to work really hard at this stage to ascertain how many people are in the region, how many Australians, you know, are dead, how many are missing. So I think that it's not just today as they try and get the information, but you know, in the days and weeks ahead.
Yeah, it's an awful story. But meanwhile, of course, the politics of governing grinds on. National Cabinet was this week. It loomed really large over the week, all week, I think, Ash. It was promising big barneys with states openly divided on a couple of issues, most notably the GST carve-up that always generates a lot of heat and light, but also AI data centres and how they're going to be powered. But as they seem to always do, Ash, the premiers and the chief ministers and the prime minister emerged on the face of it happy as Larry, best of friends. PM said the meeting was positive, listing the areas of agreement.
Firstly, we'll work together to form Australia's new national artificial intelligence laws, which will be legislated by the Commonwealth early next year, and protect our water, energy systems, and importantly, ensure that power prices are protected for Australians and that these data centres are located in the right places. We will accelerate policies to end gender-based violence because we want to see every woman and girl be able to live in the safety that they should. We have signed a new firearms agreement today. This is about improving our laws following the horrific anti-Semitic terrorist attack at Bondi last year.
But Ash, overall, PK's already declared it a bit of a fizzer. Would you agree?
I agree. There's always so much hype and build up to the National Cabinet meetings. There's flexing of muscles. The Premier's going to go in. It's almost like, you know, we had a family gathering and you sort of brace yourself for how it's going to go down. In the end, you're like, oh, that was a pretty uneventful lunch. Mm-hmm. Nobody.
Yeah, but you emerged.
No one punched
saying,
on.
Yeah, we emerged singing We Are Family. But actually, you know, all we got really in that press conference, if you think about it, which wound up very quickly. Now, either that's because the premiers all want to catch that plane home, or sometimes it's because they don't want to answer questions. And really what we got was just a laundry list and then goodbye, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was nothing. It was very hard to work out exactly what had happened. Look, it did go over, and it was in terms of media and deadlines, especially a 5 o'clock deadline at Channel 10. The press conference didn't start till 4:15, and I'm thinking, hurry up, and trying to...
I remember that feeling.
Yeah, trying to distill the information. What I did think was interesting, and I think you are right, PK and Fran, you know, that it was very much that the Prime Minister and Chris Bowen went into this saying it's going to be our way, or, you know, our way or the highway. But in the end, it wasn't that. But you also didn't have the Queensland Premier. He's not coming out crowing either. So it's not a win-lose situation.
He knows
here.
What side his bread's buttered on. But did the PM get rolled?
Yes, to an extent. So I think yes, in terms of there was this carve out, and it's not a set carve out. We need to see. There's still a long way to go in designing these national standards.
In the sake of Queensland, we've got a really big point of difference, and that is that we own distribution, transmission, generation. And that enables us to control that energy mix, and we've done that well, and our energy plan shows that. So what this does is enables us to send messages, and states can absolutely participate, what the PM says, in that social licence. Each state will have a point of difference.
But how I understand it as well, as they draw up these principles around energy, for these data centres to be approved and the energy that's used, they have to contribute to stability of the grid. Mm. They also have to lower prices. So it's almost like the Prime Minister is setting a challenge to Queensland to say, okay, fine, you want to use coal?
Eat this.
Yeah. You still have to, you know, you think it's going to be cheaper and better doing coal. Well, I challenge you, and I think perhaps that renewables will be the better way to go. But you know what? You work that out for yourself.
I think that is such a great argument. I agree. That's how he thinks. Well, okay, I'll give you flexibility, you know, that word they're using, give you some flexibility. And then, you know, he's supported by Peter Malinauskas, who went on 7:30 last night. He's a South Australian Premier, saying, no, he didn't get rolled.
Well, hardly. I think what you see emerging from National Cabinet is a genuine desire to make sure we work through the issues associated with a rollout of data centres in Australia in a way that has a degree of uniformity.
You know, they own their power. It's a different system, particularly in Queensland. So, okay, they can go it their own way. But that key bit, you're right, Ash, which is, you know, there has to be more supply in the system. It has to be competitive on price. Good luck to you, man. Like, this sort of fantasy land of super cheap coal, where is that playing out? Like, it's kind of feel like sometimes we're having...
It's playing out with the voter base, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And in Queensland, I think, you know, they are playing to their voter base there.
It might be a different argument in the NT. We heard the Chief Minister on RN Breakfast this week, quite compelling, I think, in her case that the Beetaloo Basin, which is a massive reserve of gas, is due to come on any day now, and it will be an enormous reserve of gas. And therefore, it probably would be cheaper. It's not going to be terribly expensive because they've got so much of it. The PM can probably massage that because gas is part of their mix, right?
Yeah, that's it. It backs up, you know, this renewable energy firmed up with gas. So, you don't need to fight the Northern Territory on that.
No. There's no fight over that. But I think the hairy-chested way they went in and then the whimper it came out on, and I do think there is that exactly what you say, there's that little extra caveat that's built into it where the Prime Minister can sort of see an ultimate victory, you know what I mean? But in terms of the optics, it was a little hairy-chested to then let them essentially have this flexibility, right?
I think it was, but Chris Bowen was the hairy-chested one, so, you know, he has to wear it, not the PM. I think that's where that goes. Look, the other big issue that was there was just around not just the energy and the powering of it, but the whole community support for it, the community engagement that was thrown around to BSA as we understand it. Is there a bit of a unity ticket here, at least, that this is a big issue if it's not managed properly? After all, Chris Bowen has seen the political blowback when business doesn't get social licence. You know, we saw that with the rollout of renewables and those transition lines across rural and regional Australia. And the government is saying, the federal government is saying, you have to make sure this work is done. How important is that politically? And are they all on a unity ticket there?
I think they are. I think there's no pushback on that. I think they all agree. And especially looking to overseas examples, you know, in the United States, where there are, you know, these communities are rallying against these data centers and problems. So that term social license, I think, is such a big thing. And I think that all premiers and the prime minister are on the same page with that one.
Yeah, but who could disagree with it, right? Like the idea that your communities should like it is like the no-brainer, you know, but how it's defined is different.
Well, yeah, but look what happened with the rollout of the transmission lines. And we do have this real-world example in the US where it looms large as a sort of issue with the midterms. So I think for once governments are understanding this and they're terrified of it probably. And, you know, so they're going to put down stronger guardrails perhaps in theory.
But also, you know, you look at renewables and wind farms and you look at regional communities that are divided over this. Yes, they have perhaps learnt the lesson that they went in and they didn't have that social licence, and the Energy Minister's office is trying to do work to try to get that back, but the horse is bolted in a lot of those areas. But then when push comes to shove, data centres have to go somewhere. So you can talk all you like about social licence, but how many communities are going to be like, hey, yeah, cool, I want one? Like, you know,
well, we've got a lot of open space.
We do.
Not necessarily where they want to build
them. Yeah. There's so many caveats, right? Like, if there's a housing development, that should take precedence. You know, then there are the water issues. Like, it's, you know, watch that space. The Greens are calling for the moratorium on data centres, that backlash overseas, as if we're not necessarily going to see an increase in that backlash. Like, I don't think this is a done deal for governments. I don't think it's a lockup.
Well, I don't think we're going to get a moratorium, no way.
No, absolutely.
We're not going to get a moratorium, but we're going to get more political pressure on them.
Yeah, and this is going to play out. You know, we've got legislation that'll come in next year, then there'll be a fight around that. So this is just, I think we're like chapter one, basically.
Yeah, we are. It's chapter one. All right. The next thing I want to talk about, which isn't chapter one, it's chapter, I don't know, you tell me.
7 million.
Yeah. The WA GST deal.
I thought you were going to say horizontal fiscal equalisation.
That was good. Please, how that rolled it off your tongue like that.
No, I am very lowbrow. I was thinking daddy elbow. PM kicked off the week in WA. He was unambiguously into WA, crazy about WA, crazy about the WA deal for GST, which gives them a lot of money.
There will be no change to WA's GST arrangements whilst I'm Prime Minister. That is my view. That has consistently been my view. The floor of 75% will absolutely stay. I think that WA deserves that because WA contributes to the national economy and helps to drive that economy.
Now, of course, the WA Premier, Roger Cook, welcomed this. You know, he's basically the PM's the best friend that WA's had. He's the daddy. And just a quick note, I have to address some of our lovely WA listeners' concerns about the chat Jacob and I had on the podcast, because a few of you were pointing out that the daddy label given to Anthony Albanese was a riff on the popular state daddy label Mark McGowan was often given during the COVID years. They were concerned that we didn't mention that. Okay, yeah, that's true. But like the daddy thing, Ash, is like much bigger than McGowan. I mean,
the whole thing is creepy. Could we stop saying daddy?
It's a thing. Gen Z's into it. Am I right? You know, you've got Gen Z in your household. You've got more alpha, actually, don't you?
Yeah, I've got more alpha. And I can tell you there's no daddy Albo chat in my house.
Oh, God. Some of the conversations we have are. Anyway, he basically has locked it up.
Absolutely. Signed the pledge.
Why? I mean, we know why, but
it's like this disconnect. You fly to WA and you turn into this other person, like WA first.
It's politics. Come on.
Yes. And, you know, outside of WA, it's very hard to find anybody who likes this GST deal, you know, that it is a bad deal. Everybody will tell you it's a bad deal unless you're from Western Australia. And so to go over there and really back in after there were those comments, you know, from Roger Cook, the Premier, about the Productivity Commission, and then to stand there and to be all jovial and back in the GST, I do think it was quite a bad look. Yes, absolutely, plays well in WA. They're very parochial about the GST, but the rest of the country is still looking at that.
Yeah, but let's not dive into horizontal fiscal equalisation, but it all stems because a Productivity Commission report was asked to look at it and they said it's broken, it's not working, and that's when we got these comments from the Premier over there calling them, what was it, Eastern clowns, and then
East
worse.
Coast clowns.
Yeah, it worse. And then he also described the Commission's proposals as dodgy, deceitful and quite frankly dumb. So that's pretty harsh language. I thought the former Treasury boss, Ken Henry, was really strong on this on breakfast this morning. He said the WAGST deal was stupid and he is someone who understands horizontal fiscal equalisation.
It undermines the integrity of the system of horizontal fiscal equalisation that has been core to maintaining confidence in Australia's system of fiscal federalism. That's why if a state, the wealthiest state in the nation, can come to Canberra with a begging bowl and get the rest of the country to put money into that begging bowl being held by the wealthiest people in the country, if that's how this system's going to work, then this system is going to fail.
And the PM, you know, like you say, he just stood there best of friends with Roger, Premier Daddy, WA Daddy, whatever you want to call him, and really left the other states high and dry. They noted it. They didn't like it. I reckon we'll see more about this in terms of the states probably going for a bit of a under-the-table sweetener themselves, because the Productivity Commission said it doesn't work. It's not fair. It's not how it should go. And I think it was notable that the Productivity Commissioner, Angela Jackson, pushed back on some of the slagging of the Productivity Commission. You know, she really good on it. She stood up and said, not okay.
Our view is that a line was crossed in terms of the nature of those comments from the Western Australian Premier last month. We welcome debate and we welcome criticism of our work and our report more broadly because it makes our work stronger. But to undermine and I guess attack our integrity, I think is an additional bridge too far.
I think it's really important. I think it was outrageous to call the Productivity Commission clowns when we are in this, you know, we're in this environment around the world where there's this anti-establishment push and this distrust in governments and institutions for a premier to say such things about the Productivity Commission, I think is extremely unhelpful and just feeds and fuels that. Yes, you can disagree. You don't have to call them clowns.
It's unhelpful. I mean, I personally think a premier calling it clowns is not so bad. But when the Federal Resources Minister, who happens to be from WA, Madeleine King, doesn't disavow that and, you know, says she can understand, she has some sympathy, I think, with the words, you know, I think that's not good enough. And I think the Prime Minister very clearly should say, look, you know, he's been all about civility in public discourse, right? I think he should have said something much clearer.
Well, Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, said something much clearer.
Yeah, 3 days later or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think really, let's forget a Premier. They say all sorts of things. They've got a home crowd. But the feds, they really need to stand up for these public servants. They don't necessarily need to agree, and very often they don't take on board what the Productivity Commission says. But it's an important part of our, you know, economic system and policy system. And
absolutely.
This they shouldn't have to cop this.
These are highly competent. If you've spent two minutes in the presence of Danielle Ward or Angela Jackson.
Smart people.
Absolutely, that you want looking at these things. And so they want to put out this body of work that they had to do this review. It's, you know, it's part of the legislation to do this review, you know, and then to just diss it like that so publicly is outrageous.
Yeah. And the other, just one more comment on this. Sometimes you do think, why? Like, I know the politics of the parochialness of WA. Everyone knows that. Anyone from WA tells you about it, right? But gosh, you'd think you're a Labor Premier, don't you want it? Where's the national interest sometimes? I know I'm just such a dork, but like, yeah, you can still fight for your patch, but equally just, I don't know, think about the nation. They think about the
Never
nation.
Never get between a Premier and a seats. Bucket of money, PK.
Well, let's talk about, you know, why maybe, because I think this next topic kind of may link to some of these themes, because in WA there's a state by-election coming up this weekend. That could have federal implications. Well, at least I can tell you that federal politicians, including Andrew Hastie, because it covers some of his electorate, are absolutely like studying it. Every single vote that's cast will be studied. Labor is at a high watermark in WA, right? But that could be under threat in the once safe seat of, and I love the name of this seat, Secret
Harbour. Me too. Sounds like a thriller.
I love it. I love it. It's like absolutely the sort of show I'd watch on the BBC. The electorate covers outer suburban coastal towns, classic mortgage belt area. One Nation is gunning for it. And in many ways, it's become very much a One Nation Labor fight. And so it's very interesting because of that, right? Like for so much time, we've been talking about One Nation on the right side of politics, and we saw that in Farrar-Ash. But here, we're looking at it through the prism of a Labor One Nation fight. And the Liberals over there have been trying to make it out that, you know, a win for One Nation is somehow good for the Liberals. But interestingly, Andrew Hastie's been differentiating on that, I think, in a really strong way, saying a win for One Nation is not good for the Liberals. You know, that Liberals should be fighting hard.
Look, I think this is a state election contested on state issues. And I don't accept this idea that a win for One Nation is a win for the Liberal Party. We're fighting for our lives. And we should be fighting for every single vote. So we should be fighting to win this. And the lesson from the 2021 state election is you don't wave the white flag. Voters sense weakness and they'll go to the strong horse if you signal weakness.
Yeah, I don't think in no way that a One Nation win is good for the Liberals. It puts One Nation, you know, in a seat.
It puts them in people's minds for a start. They're acceptable suddenly. They're there.
And that they, you know, they're governed, that they're in the lower house in Parliament. And, you know, I think by-elections are always a funny beast because people can go, they can almost do a protest vote and it doesn't really have massive ramifications because it doesn't change the government at the end of the day. So results in by-elections are always skewed. Anthony Green once told me that the swing, you halve it and that would be what it is.
Because it's a free kick.
Yeah, it's a free kick without a massive change. But yes, One Nation could very well, and I don't pretend to know WA politics intimately, but One Nation could very well win this on Saturday.
Well, that's going to really put a cat amongst the pigeons, I reckon. Look, just before we finish with National Cabinet, There was another issue on the agenda which didn't get any airplay at the presser that I saw anyway, and that's action on domestic violence was there. The states agreed, apparently, according to Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek this morning.
Prime Minister mentioned it at the start.
Yes, he mentioned it in the laundry list, that there was agreement on accelerating policies to end gender-based violence, including work on the second National Action Plan to end violence against women and children. Now, Community Strong Independent Zali Steggall labelled it pretty piecemeal. Crossbenchers came out this week, Ash, a number of them anyway, with a letter to the PM calling for the Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence Commission to be given extra powers, audit powers, to track whether government measures, state and federal, are actually working. And as far as I can tell, this wasn't really discussed too much. And it surprises me. I mean, we're in this environment at the moment where we've got the Sydney Swan scandal, we've got the Scots College charges. Every month we've got a number of women killed by an intimate partner. In the past few weeks we've had several of them. I would have thought that this part of the National Cabinet discussion would have been more than just a sidebar, which is the sense I got. You know, what do you think?
Going into it, it didn't have a lot of attention. Well, I can understand, I think, from in the room that there was very much that the premiers and the prime minister did have that conversation and were very keen and focused and all had their sort of head in the game, was sort of the term given to me in trying to accelerate this second plan and addressing the priorities and looking at the progress and reporting back. I think that was something that came out of it. But I think, you know, if you're looking at it from yesterday, it's again, well, can we do a bit more? And yes, those extra powers for the commissioner, they were nowhere to be seen. I understand that the government is open to that, but it wasn't something that was high on the agenda, which, you know, would be almost a tangible outcome or something to point to.
Well, something else the government's open to, and it's this a regulatory framework that's been on the books for a couple of years, and the government's getting ready to legislate, I think, around digital duty of care. And in the context of that discussion about the Swans and about the students, I spoke with Chanel Contos. Now, Chanel runs a group called Teachers Consent, and on the Radio National Hour this week, she was talking about a campaign they're running called Fix Our Feeds, which is all about trying to protect kids from getting algorithms, dangerous, toxic algorithms that flood their feeds, that take them in, you know, to some pretty explicit and dangerous areas. And this would force social media companies to let users turn their algorithms off, or more than that, opt in. Now, the timing of this is interesting. Meta yesterday in the US settled a landmark court battle over teen social media addiction. They agreed to pay billions and billions of dollars, but also put in these extra child safety measures on its Facebook and Instagram apps to protect young users from non-stop scrolling and other dangerous content. But this legislation, if it's introduced, it would be another world first. I'm not sure the government or anyone quite knows how to do it yet. But in this context, it seems like it's something the government might have an appetite for. Have you heard anything about this?
Yes, I think they're very much open to looking at this algorithm issue, but how to do it. And it's also on how many fronts are they going to fight with the social media companies, whether they want to go all in on this one as well. But I do know that it's something that is, you know, on the table.
Yeah, it is very much on the table, and they are looking at how to do it. They say, I've spoken to a couple of them, they say it's very hard to do it, but there is, well, there's extremely strong political dividend from taking action on this. We know this. Australians are really sick of this stuff, right? Like, you know, if you're a parent of a teenager and you see this, you know, what do I call it at home, crack cocaine being fed to your children and you don't have any control over it, then this is really appealing. So I do think they're exploring it, actually. And they've been world first in other areas. I think some of them are arguing, why not be world first on this as well? Like, go hard, go often, Ash. Like, it has become a kind of symbol of the government that they're willing to take them on. And it kind of wedges, I think, the opposition quite a bit too. What are they going to do? Are they going to oppose algorithm reforms, Ash? I don't reckon. Like, I don't, just good luck to you doing that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and also the opposition has always liked to come out on front on this social media stuff. So I would be very doubtful that there would be a challenge from the opposition. It would be a unity ticket.
PK and Ash, you know, so much going on in Parliament, federal Parliament, which you've been glued to this week as always. And I was interested in One Nation's dilemma this week because One Nation, completely unrelated issue, but one that's going to be there and has been there intensely over the last few weeks. One Nation was in cleanup mode after its newest recruit, David Farley's insider's appearance over the weekend, where he agreed that One Nation's immigration figures weren't, quote, too different than Labor's.
But the raw number, the raw number's not too different.
Well, the raw number's not too different, but the reality is where do we need them? We don't need them in the great urban metroplex. Mm. We need them out to be productive, working in agriculture, engineering, mining, etc.
Well, knock me down with a feather. It set off alarm bells in One Nation HQ. Party director James Ashby, wielding not just a proverbial mop but an actual one in a News 24 interview where he sought to clarify the party's position. And then Barnaby Joyce came out, somewhat nobly, I thought, suggesting that the party had been consistent all along.
It is 130,000. We've been saying it all along. It's 130,000. It's 130,000. It's 130,000 net overseas migration. Well, look, I'm not going to throw anybody under a bus. When people are new in Parliament, they can sometimes get things incorrect, and that's what happens. God knows I've done it enough.
Ash, this was messy, though. We've seen it before. Details don't really actually matter too much, it seems, when it comes to One Nation. But what do you think around this? I mean, this was a mess. They are unclear. We don't have numbers. But then again, if we're just talking about numbers, that's not going to help anyone, particularly not the government, who's going to have a higher number in the end.
Look, I don't think it hurts One Nation one bit. I think.
And why not?
Because it's more about vibes rather than facts and numbers. And I think, you know, it was very messy for One Nation. I don't think ordinary people are really watching. Who is watching, you know, insiders?
Isn't everyone?
there's a particular type of person that watches.
Spearsy, book your ears.
I know.
It's not about their numbers. They're doing very well. But it's not about that. It's about, I think your point is they're what people call high information voters that are watching, right?
Yes.
They're not the vibe people.
No, they're not the vibe people. And look, and if you're voting on immigration and that's what you know, it's the vibe of One Nation and the statements that Pauline Hanson makes, which you're going to vote on that rather than comparing the numbers. And at this stage, you know, we don't know what the coalition's number is on this NOM, this net overseas migration number.
It will be based on housing supply. It'll be capped based on housing supply. Sadly, we're seeing housing supply in this country in freefall right now. But I can say right now, given what we're seeing, we'd expect it to be substantially below 200,000, substantially below.
And also the net overseas migration number, it's one. Mm. It's one number. There are a lot of other parts to this that everybody is very focused on this NOM number. But there are other numbers that play in to this migration policy. And also, you know, and looking at this breakdown of skilled migrants and, you know, the backpackers, the student visa, all that sort of stuff. So it is very simplistic to look at the numbers, and that's why, you know, this argument around the numbers doesn't really cut through, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that is exactly, look, how I see it. I just think that for One Nation, anytime they're talking about immigration, they're so-called winning, you know what I mean? I did want to mention, though, that I thought something very interesting happened in that interview. And that's when David Farley was talking about the Prime Minister helping him out with a little problem going on in his own electorate. Do you remember that? I just found that so fascinating because
it was about Sunrise.
Yeah, go ahead, Fran, explain it to people.
It was about Sun White Rice. It's the industries in Farley's electorate. They're talking about having to cut jobs, and they are cutting jobs. That would be a big impact in that community. And I think the PM made some aside to him, "Don't worry, mate, we've got this in our sights. We're onto it. We're going to look, fix it or something like that.
I was impressed how Albanese at the Governor General's event the other night came straight up to me and said, look, I'm aware of it. I'm working on it. We'll get it done.
So he intervened, the PM.
Yep. Even after, as we left the chamber the other day, we spoke all the way across to the Senate talking about it, how could it be done and put together. So, you know, I tilt my hat to them.
And it was very deft, I thought. When I heard that from Farley, I thought, oh, yeah, that's classic Anthony Albanese. Yeah.
And so did his whole cabinet. They were like, oh, here we go again. And there's an in-joke in Labor that it's like at the highest levels of the Labor Party that he's Mr. He's recruiting all the time. Think about how many people he's made defect from the Greens, from Jackie Lambie's former network Independence. It's like he's hoovering up MPs.
I don't think he can hoover up David Farley.
Yeah, but
his
greatest victory of all would be, I'm going to take the One Nation candidate. I agree for David Farley to defect to Labor that he was a member of and gave money to. Yeah, no, he's not going to win Farah under a Labor ticket, but doesn't mean he's not playing, you know, playing with Labor, right? This is the interesting thing. And the fact that the Prime Minister has basically designed a bailout to help out this guy and the industry. I'm not saying there aren't merits generally.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of bailouts that happen. Not just
but,
this one.
But this wasn't on their radar originally, and all of a sudden it is. What do you reckon, Ash?
It also goes back to, you know, when he was leader of the House, about keeping the crossbench happy as well. You know, before the election, he had the teal independents over to the lodge for drinks.
Not sure that's going quite so well at the moment.
It's not, no. It's not going that well now. But he likes keeping the crossbench on side when he can. And this is just a signal, new MP, hey, I can do this for you because I'm the Prime Minister.
And to be fair, it's good parliamentary management. I mean, it's better if all those people that are sitting in the parliament are talking and the government's talking to them. That's better. That's the strength of that potential, I reckon. But
so that goes to, if I can take it to here, to the government's immigration policy. They're working on a policy. It hasn't been announced yet, though, but it's been, like, parts are being drip-fed. The Prime Minister's been asked today, we're recording this on a Thursday, he's denied One Nation is driving his migration policy. He's really going there at the Bush summit in Dubbo where he's talking. He says, we're worried about trying to get the numbers right. Our priority and what we're really looking at as well is people who game the system. So people who can come in and they can put in an appeal and continue to put in another appeal and go through, that's what we're working on. And I'm not here to make that announcement today, but Ash, it's the language of, we're going to crack down on these frauds. It's dipping his toe in, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think he's looking at what's happening overseas. He doesn't want the migration issue to get away from him. And so, I think you definitely see a hardening of language around it.
I think the issue is too that, to some extent, immigration figures have got away, not just from this government, the one before. We've got tens of thousands of people here, whether you call it gaming the system or applying the system, but they're here and they haven't had their appeals heard and they haven't been, they shouldn't be here. Their visas have run out, whatever it is, and the system is not able to cope with it. So the government, if they could fix that, that would be a big part of the NOM, should we just use that? That's one thing. And also, you know, there are all these other little elements of the NOM which are important: students, skilled migration, family migration, all these things. And the government needs to look at each one of them all the time. It's tricky politically, socially, but I think a big part of the problem are the ones that are here now and the system just isn't processing quickly enough or well enough. And, you know, that's probably, for some of them, they won't all be able to be sent back, but some probably, you know, fair cop.
Yeah, and then there's friend of the pod, Phil Currie, who's got a story up today about them reducing the refugee intake as well, which I think is really interesting, you know, because that was a big, big thing when they decided to neutralise the issue of boat turnbacks and back in some pretty hardline policies so they could become electable because it was such a potent issue in the community. They equally decided to increase the refugee number, right, Ash? Like that was the sort of, you know, that was kind of the deal. We will make the formal program bigger so that we can deal with our hardline policies. Now, you know, that speaks volumes too about how much the politics has changed around these issues.
Yes, absolutely. But I think that there will, if that happens, and I think there will be a lot of pushback, you know, the Greens will make a lot of noise about that. So I think, yes, we have this one, you know, there's this almost this one argument happening on migration that is dominating. But if you start messing with things like refugee intake numbers, I think that'll start a very different conversation. And I think maybe the government thinks that it'll be okay because of this one argument that's just happening. They're two very different things.
Yeah, it'd be a landmine in the base, I would have thought. Look, I just think, you know, before we finish off, it's worth noting that this debate is happening right now, this week, which is the anniversary, 25th anniversary of the Tampa affair. As I said at the start, Ash, you know, you were probably still in nappies, but I was there reporting closely on this story.
I'm not that young, but thank you.
No, she and looks young. It's not her fault.
And that event changed the way immigration is viewed in Australia and abroad. And it very much, Pika, I think you'd agree, changed the way Labor approaches
everything.
This issue, basically with extreme caution, because when Kim Beazley stood on that night in the Parliament and said he couldn't support John Howard's extreme legislation, it was extreme, giving government override powers, overriding the courts when it comes to who can come here and be here. I remember I was sitting in Parliament House in my office that night, and Labor strategists came to me and said, "We just lost the election." That was that immediate. Then, of course, 9/11 happened soon after, and, you know, the whole thing became supercharged, and John Howard masterfully, I think it has to be said, wove the two issues together, making asylum seekers and boat arrivals all about keeping Australia safe. So Labor, you know, has had internal divisions around this ever since, but, you know, basically there's kind of a tacit agreement within parliamentary Labor that this issue is dynamite for them, and they just need to kind of keep out of it if they can. But just a note for people, I would say, everyone, if you've got some time, watch this new series on ABC TV and iView at the moment. It's called Tampa, The Turning Point. It just came on this week for the anniversary. It's terrific. It's really powerful, and it just brings us all up to speed on that moment in Australia's political history and our immigration history. And it's a great backdrop for where we are now.
Yeah, it is excellent and a really defining moment, I think, in Australian political history as well. Ash, as always, you are such an excellent thinker and guest. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ash.
That's it for the Party Room today, but keep sending your questions in. We love getting them. We're especially fond of voice notes, which you can email to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And David Spears will be back with Insiders on Background on Saturday, and he's going to be speaking with Teachers Consent founder Chanel Contos, who we mentioned earlier, about this Fix Our Feeds campaign. And then, PK, you'll be back with Politics Now on Monday.
That's right, and you can follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you don't miss an episode and you find out everything.
Everything.
See you, Fran.
See you, PK.